Welcome to Why People Believe Weird Things, where we discuss some of the reasons for weird beliefs and their costs.
Ghosts.
Communication with the dead.
Aliens.
Bigfoot.
I'm Madison Gerrish.
Hey, I'm Sean Bear.
I'm Stephen Lugovich.
And I'm Katie Weintraub. And we're here today to discuss
Why people believe weird things.
So, what classifies a belief as weird, you ask? A belief can be classified as weird if it is A, not accepted by the majority of people in a particular field of study, B, is either logically impossible or decidedly unlikely, or C, lacks sound evidence and is instead backed up mainly by anecdotes or bad personal experience. So, something that lacks evidence seems nearly impossible, and it is not popularly accepted by science, hardly seems worthy of believing, right? So, why do people go to great lengths to blindly defend and spend great amounts of time and money feeding their beliefs in such weird things? Well, you see, there are both cognitive and emotional reasons behind the extreme defense in such beliefs, and obviously the cost of believing vary on the degree of weirdness in the matter. What do you guys think about weird things? Do you believe, and why? Because I know I'm pretty undecided at this point.
Well, Katie, I would probably consider myself a large believer in weird things, but on a separate note, I think it's weird. I think weird is actually a bizarre word in itself, and kind of difficult to define. I mean, what really constitutes something as weird? Personally, I think Sean's really weird.
Wow, Madison, thanks a lot.
But seriously, I don't know, I've always had a good imagination, and I've always been extremely open-minded about things like the Loch Ness Monster, the Bermuda Triangle, ESP, aliens, the list goes on and on. I just really don't find these things that out there.
Well, you see, that's where we differ, Madison. I consider myself to be pretty skeptical of almost all of those weird beliefs. Personally, when I look at my own views, I'm going to base them off of definitive scientific evidence. I need studies, and clearly, there aren't going to be studies on all beliefs, but most weird things have been evaluated. And when looking at my research, I recognize that most of them are extremely unlikely.
I'm actually kind of a convert on this issue. I used to have a lot of these weird beliefs and believe in them pretty strongly, but then one day I decided to do my homework, and after some research, I have to now consider myself a skeptic as well. I think that there's just enough strange things going on in the world today on a perfectly normal level without giving credence to things like alien abductions or the Loch Ness Monster.
Okay, Steve, but then how do you disregard stories like this? Just recently, my mom had a psychic phone call trying to get in touch with my dead grandmother. You know, it was a pretty emotional experience, and it was kind of built up. And I'll admit, even as a believer, I was a tiny bit skeptical. But I listened to the recordings, and not only did the psychic know my grandmother's initials, she also knew all about how caring she was, she knew about her award-winning flower gardens, her love of the outdoors, and even her favorite pearls. How could the psychic possibly have known all this about my dead grandmother? I mean, there's no possible way this is all just coincidence or luck, right? She has to be psychic. It seems like the only real possible explanation. And having first-hand accounts of something like this gives you such confidence in believing in something like communicating with the dead or psychics in general. And not only did the conversation give me and my mom confidence, but honestly, it made us feel better about my grandmother's passing. Call it weird or call me crazy, but after witnessing these psychic occurrences, I'm definitely a believer. I mean, the evidence seems pretty overwhelming, don't you think?
So, basically, Madison, you're saying that personal experience is your reason for believing in communication with the dead, right?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Well, Madison, you know, I understand that it's quite possible for all of those facts to be true, but what if the psychic just looked up information on your grandmother off the internet, such as the award-winning flower garden?
Okay, fair enough, Sean. But then how do you explain how the psychic knew all about how caring my grandma was, or even her favorite pearls, or her love of outdoors? There's no way just some ordinary Joe off the street could know all of that.
Well, Madison, you see, those three traits are pretty general. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone that doesn't consider themselves to be caring, or somebody that just likes to sit inside all day long. With all of these possibilities being very likely, I highly doubt that the person was even a psychic at all.
I certainly have to agree there. The person your mother talked to was most likely not a psychic. But I can also sympathize with you here in understanding why you're so committed to your belief. Personal experience makes these beliefs extremely persuasive, but that doesn't necessarily make them valid. First-hand accounts are quite often very biased. People cannot always trust what they are recalling, because memories are both constructive and creative. The brain basically looks back on the general idea, and then pieces together details that may or may not have been accurate. This leaves significant room for error.
Yeah, come to think of it, I never really did believe in communicating with the dead until I experienced it firsthand.
Yes, Steve, I agree. I mean, people also are going to use their first-hand accounts to base their judgment off of when they have had the ability often to analyze much more reliable scientific evidence. This is known as availability error. And, I mean, it's not so much that people are just ignoring all the evidence in general, but they're just ignoring the right evidence. A good example is, like, if someone decides that it's not unhealthy for them to smoke, based on the fact that one of their parents is healthy and they are smokers too, they're really not going to take advantage of the countless studies showing how dangerous smoking really is.
And there's other problems, especially pertaining to ESP, like when people attempt to analyze the probability of their personal experience happening. I mean, if somebody dreams of a terrible accident, such as someone in their family getting in a car accident, and then it actually happens, this isn't actually all that uncommon. Millions of people dream every night about terrible accidents. Obviously, it's going to happen to at least some of them.
Yep, I mean, along with these misleading probabilities, confirmation bias is an additional problem with believing in personal experience because it ignores all conflicting evidence that might contradict the previous conceptions that somebody has. I mean, people will very rarely go out and search for evidence that will disprove their beliefs. An example I've often seen in society is when old people find teenagers to be rude, but then ignore when a teenager does something nice for them, such as hold the door.
Well, all that makes sense, guys, about the brain tricking someone into believing through personal experience and confirmation bias. Is there really any harm in doing so?
That's an excellent question, Katie. Far too many people will accept these weird beliefs without giving any thought to the consequences and the cost of it. This is amplified in cases where personal experience is involved, as people become even less likely to analyze the cost of their belief. I mean, in some cases, personal finances and even livelihood can be compromised by a person becoming enveloped in the pursuit of these beliefs. Fortunately for you and your mother, Madison, your belief as you described it is usually not all that harmful to the believer. While thinking that you've contacted the dead may certainly instill some false hopes, this is a situation where those false hopes can actually be beneficial. Like you said, your mother felt better after these sessions on the phone, so this may be a case where the false belief might be an acceptable trade-off for the emotional benefits derived from it. In all likelihood, the worst thing to come out of that situation will be the phone bill, as these psychic hotlines can get very expensive.
Yeah, I guess I must have missed that part of the fine print.
I also actually read an article in the New York Times the other day about stockbrokers basing their financial trade decisions on advice they got from a psychic.
Wow, that's a pretty serious cost, especially with today's struggling economy.
Okay, so I think we've exhausted this topic enough, guys. But to move on, I saw a story when I logged on to check my email on my MSN homepage yesterday about a Bigfoot sighting, saying that a hunter in Washington was out shooting things in the woods and saw an 8-foot hairy creature roaming around in the distance, and there actually included photographs. What are your thoughts, guys? Should we believe in Bigfoot's existence based on this article? Do you think the pictures are legitimate proof, or do we need more?
Well, if you heard that on the news, Katie, then it must be true. The article even says there are actual photos of Bigfoot. That's insane. I mean, why wouldn't you want to believe them? But then again, I trust just about everything I hear in the media. I don't know about you guys, but this Bigfoot story has me convinced 100%. I mean, they can't put things on the news or the internet that aren't true, right?
Well, I'll agree with you on one thing, Madison. It's definitely insane. This is one of the biggest problems with people. Everybody takes what they see in the media to be truth without question. Frankly, the media can be one of the biggest creators of false beliefs, be they weird or just plain wrong. The general population thinks the media is unbiased and objective, and unfortunately, this just isn't the case. Every network has an agenda, and it's usually to promote a certain side of an issue. Aside from their biases, the media is actually a form of entertainment. We may forget that fact, but they never forget what their job is. It's to have the highest ratings, not to actually report useful information. They're always looking to attract a greater audience. I mean, on the day where nothing of legitimate interest has occurred, strange stories tend to come out of the woodwork. This is how a single small-town murder becomes national news, even though thousands of them occur every year. This is also how stories like Bigfoot get primetime coverage, as what obviously happened recently. People just don't evaluate their sources of news enough. They think they're all equal and unbiased, without actually checking for objectivity and the credibility of their sources. In my opinion, belief in the media being always true is one of the most widespread weird beliefs out there.
So wait. You're telling me I shouldn't trust my National Enquirer magazines and Jamie Lynn Spears didn't really have a baby?
Yeah, Madison. I guess that's what we're telling you because I completely agree with Steve. I mean, trusting the media is commonly done by the average American and is very dangerous. Like you said, Steve, the media often puts out faulty information and they're not scared to substitute the truth with something more interesting as long as it's going to sell. An article on Bigfoot or a UFO has no definitive proof, yet often is printed. Furthermore, the way the average person views the media is an additional problem. Quite often, people are quick to overlook the truth because they are only exposed to one side of a news story. This leads the viewer to not see this issue objectively at all. Most people will believe the first convincing argument they hear, which is another problem because the media is so persuasive. So basically, people are going to set on to one belief and then tend to look past the truth even when they are later exposed to it.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point, Sean. Another interesting thing that I can actually think be classified as weird is facilitated communication. Do you guys know what that is?
That's something I actually know a lot about.
Yeah, I've actually done a little research on this in the past.
I have some background in it, yeah.
Okay, so basically for our listeners, and correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but facilitated communication is a process by which a facilitator supports the arm of a non-communicative autistic patient in order to guide them in typing their thoughts through a keyboard-like device. This was actually once thought to be a serious breakthrough in helping autistic people to communicate, but it was later found that the subconscious influence of the facilitator's arm was really responsible for the results, which is actually kind of a shame, I think.
First of all, why is this even under the category of weird things? I'm actually offended. I'm offended that it's even considered a weird belief in the first place. Facilitated communication hits me really close to home. My little cousin Billy is autistic and uses facilitated communication, and it's changed my family forever. My aunt and uncle basically gave up looking for a way to talk to their son until facilitated communication came into their lives. Seeing my aunt and uncle finally smile when my cousin typed "I love you" into the keyboard really made it all worth it. My cousin, who only knew three signs, that's right, three simple basic signs, prior to facilitated communication, is now writing poetry and taking advanced classes at his high school. In fact, the other day, when my cousin Billy came to visit me, and his facilitator was actually with him, we had a conversation about two of our favorite writers, Shakespeare and James Joyce. We're all so proud of Billy and his progress, and understand now that autism is a physical disease and not a mental one. We've invested so much in facilitated communication. Come on, guys, what about hope?
Yeah, Madison, I mean, it's stories like this that just break my heart because, like Katie stated, facilitated communication was, at one point in time, believed to be a breakthrough in autism communication. However, all good tests clearly disprove FC to work, as it was advertised in the past. The tests are set up with the autistic patient having a clear view of the image and the facilitator not being able to see it. And every single time, the autistic individual could not successfully identify the image. A wrinkle in the test was to occasionally show the facilitator the image, and every time this was done, the patient could correctly identify the image.
Wow, every time? That is so surprising to me. It seems that, then, this is definitely false. There's no room to believe, really. And you would think that after these clear test results, there wouldn't be continued support from the Syracuse program. What is the believer argument, even? How do you defend that? What do people say?
Don't be too surprised, Katie. Negative energy actually has a lot to do with these test results. The facilitator and the autistic patient are used to performing FC in a calm, comfortable classroom environment. I mean, imagine yourself being put under all of this pressure. Once put into these high-pressure testing atmospheres, both the facilitator and the patient experience extreme amounts of stress. It's no wonder, and actually kind of obvious, why these test results would be so warped or skewed.
Wait a minute. Skewed? You can't look at these results and then blame them on negative energy or something like that. You can't quantify that. What you can look at and know for sure is that in hundreds of cases where they did these studies, every single time, the facilitated patient was unable to identify the object unless the facilitator saw it as well. That takes it beyond the realm of mere coincidence. That's absolute proof in the ineffectiveness of this communication.
Yeah, I mean, this test clearly proves that there was a subconscious influence of the facilitator. The facilitator is definitely guiding the subject to type the correct answer in, or whatever he or she is thinking. When looking back at the early success stories of FC, the general public really should have been more skeptical. People were easily blinded by the emotion when they heard about 5-year-old autistic patients finally being able to communicate with their family for the first time. However, when patients went from not being able to use sign language to being able to write rhyming poetry, more people should have questioned the validity of this new method of communication.
Okay, so while I understand that facilitated communication is obviously not a legitimate form of communication, I kind of have to agree with Madison on this one. Is there really a problem in believing in FC if it's helped your family out so much? What are the trade-offs in believing? Is it really wrong to believe in something just because it gives hope?
Well, I'm sorry to say, Katie, but in the case of FC, bringing hope can have severe consequences. I mean, I have to agree with Sean. FC simply doesn't work. It's been proven. Unfortunately, not only do people still subscribe to this belief, they do so without any thought to the potential costs involved. I mean, FC can be more than just misleading. It can be actually dangerous. Right away, the physical costs of equipment and training can put a strain on many people's income. But the costs truly go much deeper than just the financial. I spoke earlier about false hope, such as that Madison's mother received after speaking with her dead relative. There, I said it was acceptable, because it was mostly harmless. But here, we have an entirely different story. Many studies have proved that what comes out of these FC sessions is not the thought of the person being facilitated, but of the facilitator. Therefore, all these personal statements being made are just not true. They're a result of the facilitator's subconscious.
Yeah, I mean, imagine what must be going on inside the minds of all these people, seeing words come out that are not even their own, but are just being attributed to them. Worst of all, sometimes these false words have horrible implications. I've heard of way too many cases where the person being facilitated has laid claims of sexual and other abuse against members of their own families. This can destroy them. People have been put on trial and imprisoned upon false accusations made by the facilitator. FC doesn't set these people free, it imprisons them and their families in falsehoods.
Okay. I've heard enough. Maybe I should take a better look at the evidence and reevaluate some of my weird beliefs.
Okay, I agree, Madison. Maybe taking some of Sean and Steve's advice wouldn't be a bad idea. But it looks like we're just about out of time here. So, just remember, everyone. Whether you believe something simply because it feels good or because your brain is tricked into believing, it is important to keep in mind the costs associated with believing weird things. Is it worth it? Will believing change the basic course of everyday life? By asking important questions like these before adopting a belief, potential negative costs can be kept to a minimum. Obviously, a belief in angels is harmless if you admit to yourself that you just believe because it furthers emotional health or it feels good. A belief in blind devotion to a doomsday cult leader, however, is believed because of this sort of cognitive trickery and can yield some pretty extreme costs, including death. Sure, we've all heard of Jonestown. So, simply stated, people believe weird things out of ignorance, in order to answer taxing unanswered questions, or because of controlling outside influence that sway cognitive processes. Each belief comes with its own costs, and therefore all weird beliefs should be evaluated thoroughly before accepting this fact. This is Katie Weintraub,
Sean Bear,
Madison Garish,
and Stephen Lugovich,
signing off from Why Do People Believe Weird Things? Thanks for listening, everyone, and just remember, next time you hear a ghost story, think carefully before believing and make sure to weigh the costs.
This has been another episode of Why People Believe Weird Things, brought to you by Professor Hedwig Larsen's first year seminar. And remember that the quality of your decisions is determined by the quality of your reasoning.